But our speaker today is Kath Larkin. So Kath has been a member of Socialist Alternative for a long time, and she's a delegate in the Rail, Tram and Bus Union here in Melbourne. She's also on the organising committee for International Women's Day, and for the last few years has led the International Women's Day marches here in Melbourne. So Kath will speak for a while, and then we'll have plenty of time, like in the other sessions, for questions, contributions, that sort of thing. So give it to Kath.
I'm actually not going to start. I'm going to get someone else to start.
Here, the black abolitionist, Sojourner Truth, who was herself freed from slavery in 1827, speaks to a gathering of feminists in Akron, Ohio in 1851.
Well, children, where there is so much racket, there must be something out of kilter. I think that twixt the Negroes of the South and the women at the North, all talking about rights, the white man will be in a fix pretty soon. But what's all this here talking about? That man over there says that women need to be helped into carriages, lifted over ditches, and to have the best place everywhere. Nobody ever helps me into carriages, or over mud puddles, or gives me any best place. And ain't I a woman? Look at me. Look at my arm. I have plowed and planted and gathered into barns, and no man could head me. And ain't I a woman? I could work as much and eat as much as a man when I could get it, and bear the lash as well. And ain't I a woman? I have borne 13 children and seen most all sold off to slavery. And when I cried out with my mother's grief, none but Jesus heard me. And ain't I a woman? Then they talk about this thing in the head. What's this they call it? Intellect. That's right, honey. Well, what's that got to do with women's rights? Or Negroes' rights? If my cup won't hold but a pint, and yours holds a quart, wouldn't you be mean not to let me have my little half measure full? Then that little man there in the black, he says women can't have much rights as men, because Christ wasn't a woman. Where did your Christ come from? Where did your Christ come from? From God and a woman. Man had nothing to do with him. If the first woman God ever made was strong enough to turn the world upside down all alone, these women together ought to be able to turn it back and get it right side up again. And now they's asking to do it. The men better let them.
Not the smoothest technological transition. Okay, obviously that was a reenactment. You probably got by the close that that was not happening in 1851. So Sojourner Truth's now famous Ain't I a Woman speech, which we've just heard, was an impromptu intervention into the 1851 Women's Convention in Akron, Ohio, and it was a response to another participant in the crowd. So this wasn't one of her very many famous speeches as such, as it was a her kind of responding to someone else at a conference. So the version we've just listened to has become the famous speech that many of us who want to fight sexism and racism will quote and look to and take inspiration. But what I'm part of what I'm going to talk about today is that there's actually a lot of evidence to suggest that she never quite said those exact things, at least not at that time, in that way. And there's three women who I want to particularly thank, who've given me the kind of resources to kind of know more about Sojourner Truth. And that's Nell Irving Painter, who is an American woman, an African-American woman, who spent most of her kind of academic life, I guess, becoming a scholar of sorts, mostly particularly focused on the experience of Southern slavery and rebellion. But she made it her mission to kind of learn more about Sojourner Truth and spent a long time in, you know, archives, going back and retracing Sojourner Truth steps, and particularly using a lot of kind of primary resources, something that is actually lacking from a lot of what's talked about in regards to Sojourner Truth. And I want to thank the bulk of where I got my information to understand Sojourner Truth's life is actually from Sojourner Truth herself and Olive Mashett, Olive was an escaped slave herself, who, having met Sojourner, was inspired by Sojourner, wanted to record her story. And so Sojourner Truth basically narrates her life to Olive, who writes it down. And that's the bulk of where I got my research information. Not quite exactly what she said, we think, in all likelihood. So a few things. Truth was not Southern. She was from the North and spoke only Dutch till she was about 9. And most of her political life was surrounded by white people. It was the bulk of the people that she worked with in the abolitionist movement were middle-class whites. So a lot of historians have conjectured that she's very unlikely to have ever said ain't or spoken in a Southern accent or had those particular affectations. She also didn't have 13 children. She had 4. Her mother had 14. There's nothing really to suggest that Truth was prone to inventing offspring. But really, it's not just that. It's also the fact that the very first reports of the speech that were published by the New York Tribune shortly after the conference in 1851, and The Liberator, which was an abolitionist journal, so sympathetic to Truth's arguments, written 5 days later, both of those accounts didn't have the full transcript of what she said, but none of them mentioned the supposedly repeated phrase, "Ain't I a woman?" The first complete transcript that we have of the speech appears 2 weeks later in the Anti-Slavery Bugle, and that was published and written by the convention's recording secretary, Marius Robson. And again, the question, "Ain't I a woman or am I not a woman?" doesn't appear in these accounts either. Obviously, it's possible that Marius was wrong, that he didn't write it down properly, but, you know, given that he was very much on the side of the abolitionists, a supporter of Truth, and the recording secretary of the conference, it sort of seems unlikely that he would have been so widely far from what actually got said. So this version of the speech that we've just listened to, the famous version that is worth taking some stock of, was first published 12 years after the conference by Frances Dunner Baker. And this is the first time the phrase, "Ain't I a woman," is attributed to that particular speech. And it's her version that gives Truth the extra children and the kind of affectations of a Southern slave. And this is the version that has become famous. So we don't know whether Truth did have this particular question in her speech, but it does seem somewhat likely that either in this speech or in others, she used some variation of the phrase, "Am I not a woman?" as it was a really common refrain of the abolitionist movement at the time. So the phrase, "Am I not a man, a brother," had been used by the British abolitionist movement since the 18th century, and in the 1820s, British abolitionists use the feminine version of this phrase, am I not a woman, am I not a sister? And it entered the American abolitionist movement in 1830 by the abolitionist newspaper The Genius of Universal Emancipation, which included the image of a slave woman asking, am I not a woman and a sister? And this image was widely republished in the 1830s, and it was struck into a copper token and you know, became a real symbol for women in the movement. Although, notably, they took out the question mark to kind of give the comment a sort of a positive answer. Historian Jean Fagan Yellen argued in 1989 that this motto had served as an inspiration to Sojourner Truth, who was well aware of the great differences of experiences of sexism between white and black women. And it was sort of a major contribution that she made to the anti-slavery movement, was you know, particularly focusing questions of women's rights. I kind of wanted to add in, I noticed when I went last night to Janie Stone's absolutely fantastic kind of multimedia extravaganza of film and, sorry, of music and poetry throughout 1968, that the civil rights movement again took up some of these slogans. So the striking sanitation workers who Martin Luther King marched with held up signs, I am a man. So, you know, and I think it's pretty common that that kind of demand to assert your humanity comes up time and time again in civil rights movements, you know, around the world and for various oppressed groups. So, onto the kind of life and times of the story of Sojourner Truth. The more that I read and investigated about Truth, the further away from the symbol she started to appear to be, often referred to as an escaped slave, a southerner, having 13 children. But there's a very particular image that you start to develop, which didn't really match up with her true story, or what I believe to be her true story based on the evidence that I talked about from those three women. And while the symbol that she became, I think, is undeniably important, both for black women of her time, but also for those of us who are fighting against sexism and racism, and particularly for left-wing black women today, I also felt like her actual story did deserve to be told. So that's what I'm going to try and do for a little bit now. So born Isabella Bonfrey into slavery in the state of New York in 1779, Sojourner Truth's personal story as a slave, unsurprisingly, is one of much hardship. Slavery in the North had some differences to slavery in the South. Say, slaves often worked alongside poor whites and indentured labourers, and the fact that the North turns away from slavery is motivated not only, or I would argue even primarily, by questions of social justice, but it's also about the fact that slavery kind of starts to diminish in kind of its economic utility as the economy is becoming, you know, more industrialised, and there's sort of a something of a move away from sort of, you know, farm work. And then there's also a question, obviously, we know that the Civil War was also about economic competition between the southern and northern states. Unfortunately, I don't have time to kind of go into all the details of slavery and abolition and the civil rights, Civil War, but I think that these are kind of important to have in the back of our mind. Nonetheless, reading the narration of Sojourner Truth, you're really struck by, despite the differences or the kind of lighter images we often have of northern slavery, that slavery was undeniably just as brutal and cruel in the North. In particular, I think I felt my heart, you know, breaking the most when I read about the accounts of her parents and of older slaves' experiences of so-called liberation. So her parents, Elizabeth and James Bonfrey, after a lifetime of servitude, were liberated in the last years of their failing health. Really, their masters were liberated from the responsibility of having to care for dying slaves. After a lifetime of abuse and hard labour on which the American economy is built, slaves were tossed out into the wilderness more often than not, to die painfully and slowly from neglect, from lack of medical attention and food. Unsurprisingly, at the end of a lifetime of slavery, you're not exactly the most able-bodied or healthy in your last years of life. So Truth recounts the agony of her blind and crippled father after her mother's death. "Oh," he would exclaim, "I had thought God would take me first. Mama was so much smarter than I and could get about and take care of herself. And I am so old and so helpless. What is to become of me? I can't do anything anymore. My children are all gone. And here I am, left helpless and alone." And then as I was taking leave of him, he raised his voice and cried aloud like a child. Oh, how he did cry. I hear it now and remember it as well as if it were but yesterday. The poor old man. He thought God had done it all, and my heart bled within me at the sight of his misery. So while the Ardenbergs, his former masters, for some time took pity on their supposedly favourite slave, they permitted him to stay short periods in their various family homes for a while, often making him walk incredibly long distances to get between the homes as they got sick of having him in one. But eventually they tired entirely of the whole routine. Apparently their favourite slave was taking too long to die, and James was told he could no longer stay with them. The Ardenbergs liberated two more slaves, Caesar, who was the brother of Elizabeth Bomfrey, and his wife Betsy, on the understanding that they would support James. The three of them, for some time, did live in a rudimentary log cabin, and there is some sense that there was some joy in this brief period of their lives. And they did do their best to care for each other, but it was not long before Betsy and Caesar died. Alone, blind and helpless, no longer permitted to visit the Ardenbergs, no way of contacting any of his children, James still did not die for some time. One day, another old freed slave, Soane, called at his shanty, and James begged her to stay for a while to help him to wash and tend to his sores, to rid him of the vermin and filth that had covered on his body that he was no longer strong enough to move away. Soane herself was an emancipated slave, old and weak, with no one to care for her, and feeling that she too might get sicker and perish there without assistance, she recounts that it was with great reluctance and a heart swelling with pity that she felt obligated to leave him in his wretchedness and filth. Shortly after her visit, James was found on his miserable pallet, frozen and stiff in death. He died chilled and starved, with no one to speak to, no kindly word or a kindly deed for him in the last dreaded hours of his life. And I wanted to tell which I think is a pretty gut-wrenching story, because I think it speaks to the deep inhumanity of slavery, and if there was ever any doubt that things were perhaps a bit better in the North, I think this starts to chip away at that. So Isabella, or Sojourner Truth, was sold into the slavery at the age of 9 for $100 and a herd of sheep. A Dutch speaker, she quickly learned English, as she was severely punished for not understanding her masters. Truth was sold and resold a number of times, eventually forced to marry an older slave named Thomas, with whom she had four children named Peter, James, Elizabeth and Sophia. And Nell Irving Painter, in her record, says that it appears that Thomas and Sojourner didn't hate each other. They, on some level, enjoyed each other's experience, but this certainly was not somebody who was the love of her life, and there's no sense that they attempted to create a life together. Slave marriages were not legally recognised as real marriages, because obviously slaves were not considered people but property, but it wasn't uncommon for slave owners to force slaves together for the purpose of reproducing more slaves. And in her later years, Truth actually laments to having been born into slavery. She, in fact, took great pride in bringing prosperity to the home of her masters by bearing children, And it was up to the mothers of slave children in their earliest years to, I guess, socialise them and prepare them for a life of slavery. So she taught her children, much like she had been taught, the importance of obedience herself at many times, reprimanding the children in a similar fashion to the way the master of the house would reprimand and punish his slaves. And to speak about this is not to criticise her as a mother or detract from obviously the fierce advocate that she becomes, but I think it is important to have a sort of honest reflection on the way that slavery strips people of their humanity, it warps people's sense of themselves and the people around them. So on to her supposed escape from slavery. And there is something of I guess, an escape that occurs here. Really, you know, in a technical sense, she remains a slave until slavery is abolished in the North in 1827. Her sort of second last master, John Dumont, had made her a promise to liberate her a year early, because they're all going to have to liberate their slaves anyway, if she worked hard enough. But in that year, or I say but actually probably there was never any intention to liberate her. It was probably always just a way to try and drive her to work harder. In that year, Mrs. Dumont punished Truth particularly brutally for a very simple mistake. Obviously, English was her second language, and she did occasionally still make mistakes. And Truth accidentally brought her the wrong kitchen utensil. And as Mrs. Dumont raged at her for her insolence, Truth says that she sort of put up her hands to protect herself because she was so afraid. Mrs. Dumont took this as an act of defiance and plunged her hand and held it in a boiling pot of oil, which forever crippled her hand. Unsurprisingly, she was then less productive that year. And when she came to Mr. Dumont after her year was up, when she was promised her freedom, he determined that she had not done enough to earn the early release. As she always did with troubles in her life, she prayed to God for guidance and help, and she believed that it was God who led her in her escape. She did her best to get ahead of her chores in the lead-up to this escape, so as not to inconvenience her masters too greatly, and she left one morning with her youngest child. So she ended up in the home of Quaker couple, Mr. and Mrs. Van Wagner. Being Quakers, the Van Wagners were abolitionists. They gave Truth employment as a maid. Not long after, her former master, John Dumont, came to the house and demanded Truth return with him. Eventually, the Van Wagners struck a deal with Dumont in which they brought Truth and her child. So she did really remain a slave till the end of slavery that year, but certainly this year was not a year full of the same sort of torture and kind of horrific treatment that she'd experienced. And it was with the support of her final masters, the Van Wagners and the Quaker community, that Truth led and won a court case in New York to win back her 5-year-old son, Peter, who had been illegally sold to a man in Alabama. It was illegal at the time to sell minors across state lines. And this is a pretty important victory because it meant not only securing Peter's freedom in an immediate sense, but rescuing him from the South meant saving him quite possibly from death, certainly a lifetime of slavery. You know, and this was a time when women were generally prevented even from presenting their own cases in court, let alone black women, let alone slave women. So it's a pretty landmark case and showed a lot of, I guess, determination and bravery on her part. Nonetheless, clearly this isn't this sort of kind of Django Unchained type rebellion and escape story. You know, the escape, you know, was not politically motivated. I mean, on some level, or everything is political, but certainly not in a conscious way. It was simply that she felt that she had worked hard for something that she was promised, and thought it was pretty unreasonable that this opportunity was taken away from her. Though from her own records, she is at pains to explain how she did everything she could to cause as little distress to her masters as possible. Nonetheless, I think the courage it must have taken to leave her masters, to go against everything that she'd been brought up to do, and to fight that court battle to save her son, is certainly worthy of incredible admiration. So I'll move into, I guess, the period of her life after slavery. Her first few years after slavery are spent in a religious cult called the Kingdom of Matthias. After about 3 years, the cult sort of fell apart, really, after the cult leader is charged with murder. Seems more like her case of neglect, but, you know, these cults are not particularly nice places. And so Isabella went in search of a new community and a new home. Shortly after taking the name Sojourner Truth, having a commitment to indeed be a Sojourner of Truth, that is, a travelling preacher, she finds herself sometime around 1843 to 1844, there's a debate about this, which year it was, she comes to Northampton, which was a home to radicals, abolitionists, with utopian ideals. And Truth settles in another commune, the Northampton Association of Education and Industry. Very much different to the Kingdom of Matthias, this commune allowed her to have her children with her and was an egalitarian collective in which everyone laboured and worked together for the benefit of everyone else in the collective. They were abolitionists, women's rights advocates, and, you know, essentially sort of utopian agrarian socialists. The commune was both home to and a meeting place for many radicals, and this is where Truth first comes into contact with some of the famous abolitionists we know today, such as William Lloyd Garrison, who is a prominent white abolitionist leader and a leader of the Anti-Slavery Association who ran the newspaper The Liberator, and George Thompson, a British abolitionist and MP, who was the first to really notice Truth's incredible oratory skills and began to take her on speaking tours. This is also where she comes into contact with Frederick Douglass, who I would assume most people or a number of people here would have heard of. So Frederick Douglass is a former slave who escaped thanks to the woman who would later become his wife and was herself a leading figure of both the women's rights and abolitionist movement, Anne Murray Douglass. And it's in this period that Truth really starts to develop politics. So she's armed with the kind of moral authority of having a direct connection to God, which no doubt emboldened her to speak her mind, and you would have thought would impact the kind of, impact her speeches would have. So somewhat utopian socialist in her outlook, Truth, like those around her, looked to and hoped to create an egalitarian society in which slavery and the degeneration of women was totally abolished. As part of her speaking tours, Truth recruited former slaves and others, both black and white, to fight in the Civil War against the South between 1861 and 1865. During and after the war, she continued to advocate for slaves and former slaves and became a nurse in the refugee camps, helping to establish a freedman's hospital. For years after the war, Truth lobbied governments to provide land and financial compensation to freed slaves, and herself raised money and donated money to freed slaves to help them purchase farmland in the Midwest. Now, ideally, she'd sort of hoped to create a whole new kind of agrarian, larger kind of agrarian socialist community. When illness finally did curtail her activities, Truth joined one last reform community or commune, the Battle Creek Sanatorium, founded by healthy living activist Dr. John Harvey Keelog. Truth died in Battle Creek, Michigan in 1883. So I want to talk a bit about American first wave feminism, which really is the context of Truth's speech or her comments at the Akron, Ohio Women's Convention. So now I guess we have a bit more of an understanding of Truth. I think it's worthwhile to talk about what this political period look like? The Akron Women's Convention in 1851 occurred in a period known to most of us as First Wave Feminism. First Wave Feminism really is an incredibly long period from the early 19th century to the achievements of women's suffrage in the 1920s. So there's a whole lot of, I guess, waves, strategies, philosophies and politics that occurred in this quite long stretch of time. So women had been or were involved in both the labour and abolitionist movement, and fought in particular for things like shorter work days, safer factory conditions, a living wage and the abolition of slavery, but largely had not been motivated by demands which were explicitly about women's rights as a kind of separate thing. Until about roughly the 1830s. The look to women's rights, I think, were inspired by the kind of egalitarian ideals that were embodied in the labour movement and the abolitionist movement. The 1830s were in particular a turbulent time in American politics, with a major kind of strike wave and significant industrial unrest. And the Lowell Female Labour Reform Group was the first women's rights activist group, which was made up of women factory workers. And it was common for these women labour activists to invoke images of sisterhood and solidarity with African American slaves, but typically they didn't really work together as one. It was seen as two struggles that had, you know, some kind of commonality, some sort of should have some sort of support for each other, but didn't kind of work together as the one movement. And in the 1830s, hundreds of women's anti-slavery organisations came into being following the criminalisation of slavery in the North. These groups were largely populated by middle-class white women. Nonetheless, women faced a lot of resistance to their playing a leading role in the abolitionist movement, particularly from male religious authorities who were so prevalent. In 1837, the Congregationalist Ministers Association of Massachusetts issued a pastoral letter asserting that the power of woman is in her dependence, and they condemned any of that sex who so far forget themselves as to itinerate in the character of public speakers and teachers. Women are like vines, whose strength and beauty is to lean against the trellis work of the home. But when she thinks to assume her independence and overshadow the work of the elm, she will not only cease to bear fruit, but will fall into the shame and dishonour of the dust. So that'd go for a lot of women at this conference, I would have thought. I don't really feel all that much shame, dishonour, and I certainly don't appear to be dust. And it was in the face of this kind of sexism within the movement that women activists really start to develop writings and theories about the ability for women to be equals in the campaign. Bearing in mind, again, that these abolitionist groups were largely white and middle class. So in this period of evangelical awakening, in the mid-19th century social reformers, many of them did embrace a whole range of causes, including peace, women's rights, racial justice, labour rights and temperance. Labour activists, radical Quakers and abolitionists debated the proper role for women in these movements. And in 1848, the first convention for women's rights was held. Suffrage was a key demand at that conference. Among the men and women, black and white, who attended the conference was firm supporter of women's suffrage and previously mentioned abolitionist Frederick Douglass. The conference resolved that all laws which prevent women from occupying such a station in society as her conscience shall dictate, or which place her in a position inferior to that of a man, are contrary to the great precept of nature, and therefore are of no force or authority, i.e. women should not obey laws which keep them down. And from this period on, there are many conventions and meetings, discussions about the rights and role of women, despite the fact that there did continue to be both external and internal opposition to women's involvement. And these conventions were largely attended by middle-class whites, as well as former slaves who had made their way into reformist circles like Sojourner Truth. So if you kind of force forward up to 1851, the Women's Convention in Akron, Ohio, this is the speech where Sojourner Truth makes a speech that she's become famous for. But it's also important, I think, that we remember that throughout most of this period, she is going around speaking against slavery and for women's rights. Whether or not she made that exact speech, it was very much the case that she was going around making a whole number of obviously powerful speeches about women's rights and abolition. She's well known as being someone who fought for the voices and concerns of black women in the women's rights movement, which of course is what we're examining in this speech. But she was also famous for fighting for women's rights and for ensuring the rights of women were taken up in the anti-slavery and later anti-racist movements. So in 1867, several years after the abolition of slavery and the Civil War, when female suffrage is still very much being debated, Truth argued, "I feel that I have the right to have just as much as a man. There's a great stir about coloured men getting their rights, but not a word about the coloured woman. And if coloured men get their rights, and coloured women not theirs, the coloured men will be masters over the women, and it will be just as bad as before." I just think it's important to note that there was, you know, debates on, I guess, both sides of these sort of movements. But to return to the kind of famous Ain't I a Woman speech. The speech is aimed at redefining and examining the way in which womanhood is understood. Womanhood was not just associated with whiteness, but also with kind of middle-class images of well-to-do ladies. I'm sure factory workers, white or black, did not get carried over puddles and given the best of everything. Truth's arguments would no doubt have given expression to a visceral anger and frustration felt by working class and black women, whose experience would have felt often left out of the struggle by these middle-class organisations. Even though, no doubt, most of these people saw themselves as being on the side of abolition and in opposition to slavery. It gave voice to that sort of double and compounded experience of racism and expression, much like the image that we spoke about earlier. And so when I initially started researching Sojourner Truth and her speech, I was sort of really annoyed about the historical inaccuracy that seemed to create this kind of image and symbol that felt like a departure from her true story. And, you know, I just kept thinking, this woman's actual story is incredible on its own. Why all of the mythologizing? Truth becomes particularly famous in the 1850s. When Harriet Beecher Stowe, in her best-selling anti-slave novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin, described Truth as the Libyan Sibyl, which is like a prophetess from Greek mythology. Stowe both idealises and exoticised Truth, describing a physically powerful African, almost unnatural and strong and dignified, a charismatic religious fanatic who believed God could talk to her. She was not alone in that. That was kind of stock standard for itinerant preachers at the time, to believe that they were speaking to God. Nonetheless, symbols do matter. They can inspire people to lift their heads a little higher, to believe in themselves and to fight a little harder. So while I did want to talk about the story of Sojourner Truth, because I believe even without the mythologizing, she's very impressive, she was also one of just many actually very inspiring women who participated in the struggle. I can believe that even if she didn't say these exact words in the speech we now celebrate, she no doubt stood for the core arguments within that speech. I think it's also important and right that both abolitionists and women's rights movement have such an image to look to. I kind of remembered something my dad used to say, never let the facts get in the way of a good story. In this case, you know, do we really need to fret? Does it make much difference whether she had a southern accent, exactly how many children she had, or whether she asked that question on that particular day in that particular moment? What matters surely is that she's rightly remembered as a fighter, an abolitionist, a women's rights activist that we can look up to today. And I think those arguments are just as true of the movements today as they were then. Black women and poor women still experience their sexism in a different way to middle-class women. Maybe you can see it. In Black Feminist Thought, Knowledge, Consciousness and the Politics of Empowerment, published in 1990, Patricia Hill Collins provides an updated version of the same contradictions raised by Truth. If women are allegedly passive and fragile, then why are black women treated as mules and assigned heavy cleaning chores? If good mothers are supposed to stay at home with their children, then why are US black women on public assistance forced to find jobs and leave their children in daycare? If a woman's highest calling is to become mothers, then why are black teen mothers pressured to use Norplant and Depo-Provera, which were strong oral contraceptives with dubious side effects? Today's fights for women's rights still has something to learn from Truth. Any campaign that seeks to lift up women must acknowledge the impact of racism and class in the struggle for women's rights. This is exactly why we, as members of Social Alternatives in the struggle here in Australia, organising in women's rights campaigns, have argued to place some of those questions front and centre. Myself and other comrades have consistently argued against imperialist and racist feminism and pushed for the movement to take up questions of Islamophobia and the experience of refugees, despite frequent pushback in the women's space. We've also fought to put working class women and our unions at the front and centre of these campaigns. And we're proud to fight, we were proud in the last, at the last International Women's Day rally, to fight for the right of striking early childhood educators fighting for equal pay to be literally at the front and centre of that march, despite the others in the movement with identity politics who did not want to see that. As socialist class is not just another oppression, we do look to the working class not just because they're oppressed, but because it's workers who ultimately have the economic and social power to bring the system which necessitates sexism and racism to its knees. Much like we look to Sojourner Truth, not because she was a victim of the system, but because she was a militant fighter against it. And I think it's important to note, for those who may misuse her legacy, that Truth was not a separatist. She spent her life working alongside men and women, black and white, for a fairer and more egalitarian world. But of course, it's not just proponents of identity politics who wish to use Sojourner Truth, but the conservative forces of the American state. When Michelle Obama unveiled the bust of Sojourner Truth, she said, "I hope that Sojourner Truth would be proud to see me, a descendant of slaves, serving as the First Lady of the United States of America." Given everything we know about Sojourner Truth's commitment not only to the abolition of slavery and for the advancement of women's rights, but her desire for a truly egalitarian and peaceful society, it's hard to imagine that she would smile upon the Obama government and administration, which saw more immigrants deported than any other previous American government, that dropped more bombs than Bush, dramatically expanding their air wars and the use of special forces around the globe, and has seen more black men languish in American prison industrial complex with the virtual reintroduction of slavery in America. Sojourner Truth's commitment to solidarity and striving for an egalitarian society means that she's a figure that we on the left should claim and not let her languish as left cover for opportunistic and brutal governments. I don't want to look at her anymore. Though I have stressed that her life may not be quite what the myth makers have made it out to be, this does not make her any less worthy of admiration. Because at the end of the day, who is she? What is she? What does she represent? A woman who survived the great brutalities of slavery with her humanity intact. A woman who fought the state and won her son at a time when women were most often prevented from even appearing in court. A famous public speaker who was so impressive that the abolitionist groups raised money to fund Truth to travel around the country agitating for abolition, recruiting people to fight in the Civil War. So effective and terrifying a speaker was she that slaveholders tried to prevent her from coming to their towns, once threatening to burn down a town hall where she was scheduled to speak. And what did she say to that? I will speak upon its ashes. A passionate advocate and fighter for women's rights and an end to slavery and inequality of all stripes, this is a woman who undoubtedly is worthy of great respect and admiration for anyone who wants to fight for a better world today.